From Bigfoot to ghosts, aliens to the afterlife, this is Nightcast. And now, here is your host, Ian Morris.
Welcome to the night. Is it possible that things in folklore and myths actually do exist? Well, tonight on Nightcast, we're going to be talking about one of those, vampires. Our guest tonight is a vampire expert, novelist, and historian. She has written three books, To Be His Soulmate, Adrian's Fury, and Adrian's Legacy, the Adrian Trilogy. Joining us tonight to talk about vampires from Louisiana, Lynn Gibson. Lynn, welcome to Nightcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian. I'm excited to be here.
Now, Lynn, you're a vampire expert, a historian, a novelist. You're the author of the Adrian Trilogy. But what else about Lynn Gibson? Who is Lynn Gibson? Tell us who you are.
Okay. I was raised down here in the Deep South. Part of my youth was in Mississippi. I'm in Louisiana now, Southeast Louisiana. I was a little bit different than the rest of the kids my age, especially in school. I can remember back when I was 4 or 5 years old. I saw when I was young, and I still see now. But, I would have conversations with people who weren't there. So my parents, were a little bit concerned. And they were very religious, Southern Baptist, and you just didn't talk about things like that. That wasn't acceptable. There was something wrong with that. So I kind of learned how to keep it to myself, and my outlet was writing. I was very young when I started writing, and I started with Gothic poetry before there was such a thing as Gothic poetry. Kind of wrote about the things that I saw and the way those things made me feel. Of course, that deeply disturbed my parents. They didn't care for such things. But that, I just kind of learned that people, not everybody is alike. People see things and some people don't. So I just kept things to myself until I got a little bit older and found some counseling through a lady that, she was a medium, and she worked hand in hand with NOPD and several other law enforcement agencies on homicides and things like that. And when we first met and I started telling her about myself, she stopped me and she picked up and started telling me about myself. And we spent many years together, her training me how to kind of, I guess, tap into my inner sight. And it's like a muscle. You know, if you flex a muscle, it builds and it gets stronger and you're able to use it. So I worked with her for quite a while and kind of put that behind me in my 20s when I got married and had my first child. And that's where all my focus and attention went at that point.
So, Lynn, do you have psychic ability?
I don't like the word psychic just because of how society views that word, but I do see things and I do feel things. I was a lot more in tune when I was probably in my 20s and 30s, but there comes a point to where you don't want to see anymore, so you stop using that muscle. That muscle gets weaker.
Okay, but then you have the ability to see things.
I do.
You do, but you choose not to utilize that right now.
I do. Everybody's seen the movie Ghost with Whoopi Goldberg in it, right?
Yes.
And it was funny when all the ghosts and everything were trailing around behind her, and that was great then for the movie. It's not good in real life.
I see.
And as I said, I would work these cases with this lady, and these victims would show you and tell you what happened, and you saw the whole thing, but what they didn't understand was the term material evidence. Us in the living world, we have to have some material evidence to convict, and they don't understand that, and they don't sleep. So they follow you constantly, aggravating you and crying, and they're angry because nothing has been done to vindicate them. So, it gets to be a little bit too much after a while, and I had to let that go.
So now, being in the South, especially in Louisiana, there's a lot of folklore, there's a lot of legends, and that seems to be one of your interests as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of cool legends right here in this area, especially the New Orleans area. If you get down and you start digging, and you can talk to locals there that will actually open up to you and tell you things, then it's pretty neat the things you can find out. Mm-hmm.
And so you're also interested in all things paranormal. What other things other than vampires are you interested in?
Well, of course, ghosts, spirits, things of those sorts. And we'll talk later about a project that I'm working on now, but it's a fiction based on truth with a lot of references to not just the King James Bible, but to other ancient holy texts. So I'll tell you about that later.
And after school, you enlisted in the military.
I did. I enlisted. I was in the Army for a while. I was in training to be a field evac medic. This was in the early 80s when they were allowing females to come into the military, but they weren't real crazy about it. So I did not get to spend my entire term in there. I had some issues with my stomach, and that was a red flag because there was some medical problem. So it was like a check, and, you know, I was honorably discharged and went into management at that point and spent about 30 years in management.
Well, the service that you did was really outstanding. And, of course, we at Nightcast and all our listeners want to thank you for your service. You are in Louisiana, and you've done some other interesting things in your life regarding nightclubs and real estate. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I started out in restaurant management when I was 17. Spent about 20 years, somewhere around 20 years in that, and decided that I would go start part-time doing the bar thing. I do it 2 or 3 nights a week, and then it got to where it was more profitable than the restaurant thing, so I left that. And then as I got older, the bar scene got really old, so I went and got my real estate license. And about 4 years after I was licensed, I got my broker's license, and I managed one of the largest brokerages here in the southeast of Louisiana. There were 70-some-odd agents under me at one time, and if you can imagine, with about 85% of them being female, it was pretty hectic. So I started writing in 2011 just to kind of de-stress because my life had normalized. My son's grown, and got that first book out at the end of 2012.
And that was to be his soulmate?
That's right. That's exactly right.
Right. And we're going to get to those books a little bit later. Lynn, you also like art and painting and masonry, stone masonry?
I sure do. I'm actually standing here looking at my entrance. My husband ran across an old map from Jean Lafitte. He was a pirate here in Louisiana. And he tweaked the compass on his maps to where, or the legend on his maps to where you never could tell what north, south, east, or west was. So I took that legend and drew it out on my floor and actually did that in mosaic tile right here at my front door. It's kind of cool that you mentioned that because I'm sitting here staring at it.
Okay, so how did the transition into a vampire historian and expert, how did you transition into that?
Okay, that's interesting. As I said, I self-published that first book in 2012. And being in management and real estate, I realized that I did not have the time or the ability to market my product. So I started looking for a publisher. And in February of 2013, I signed a contract with Donna Inc. Publications. And there was a wait list before my book would be republished. I think it was close to a year. So in that time, she gave me a blog and she said, you need to blog things in your genre and start building a fan base. So I did that. I did the vampire history and lore from all over the world, and, you know, that's what really got me into it, because I would find one story, and then I would do back research on it, and I would make sure I found other references to it in other materials in history so I could collaborate the story and, you know, make sure everything matched and that it wasn't just some crazy thing that got put out there on the web, you know. Got way into that, and just speaking on that, there's a college professor in India that has his class reference my blog for projects, and I think it has something to do with the paper they have to write at the end of the year to get out of his class. So that's pretty cool to have people referencing my material to get out of college.
So you've done extensive research into vampires?
Absolutely.
Why the vampire? I mean, you, if you're interested in other paranormal things, why did you focus on vampires? Does it have to do with the area that you're living in? Does it have to do with anything that you've experienced?
Actually, a little bit, because there are some really great vampire legends here in the New Orleans area. But I focused more on it because I was an 80s child, and we had Jay Anson and Stephen King and, you know, all of the great horror guys, and that's what I grew up watching. And here comes Twilight. And trust me, I'm not slamming Twilight because it got the young kids to read. That's a great thing. But what is in those books are not vampires. And that's what got me to put my foot down and say, okay, we're going to do this the right way. We're going to bring them back the right way so that this generation actually knows what a vampire really is. It's not some kid at school that sparkles in the sunlight. You know, this is what a vampire is. They are evil. They're vicious. They're ancient. They're, you know, incredibly strong and incredibly beautiful in most legends. And now in some of the foreign legends, a vampire is not a beautiful thing. It is a horrid creature. So it really depends on which region and which era we're talking vampire in.
So you say that there's vampire legends in Louisiana?
Oh, yes. There's a great one about the Comte de Saint-Germain. You know, I did some extensive research on him. You can find that on my blog. The date of birth is a little etchy because you can find references back to the 12th century, but in 1709 was the most, I guess, fluid date that I could find references to where people had seen him. And these are notable people that had seen him and had encounters and described him and talked about his mannerisms. They said he was brilliant. He was a master of everything. But you never saw him out in the daylight. He would host these very lavish dinner parties and have the most elite, you know, people in the area come and visit with him. And he would talk through the entire meal. He may drink wine, but he would never lift his fork and he would never eat anything in front of anyone. He mastered many musical instruments, and he would sometimes perform for his guests. And sometimes, I think there were three occurrences that were recorded where he actually performed in public. He moved to a house on the corner of Ursuline and Royal in the French Quarter in 1909. And he was there for a couple of years until a terrible event happened and, you know, the police came and he had vacated the property at that point. But there were bottles of blood stored everywhere and, you know, all kind of evidence of homicide and just terrible things that they found in there. But his history doesn't stop there. There are references beyond that and even into the 1970s, if I'm not mistaken. So very interesting read.
Interesting vampire stories out of Louisiana. Lynn, we're going to have you hold right there. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to be asking Lynn about vampires. Lynn Gibson and I will meet you on the other side of the break. I'm Ian Morris. We'll be back.
This is Nightcast.
Welcome back to Nightcast. We're back from break. I'm Ian Morris. Our guest this evening is a vampire expert, historian, and novelist. She is the author of the Adrian Trilogy, To Be His Soulmate, Adrian's Fury, and Adrian's Legacy. Lynn Gibson from Louisiana joins us this evening on Nightcast. Lynn, let's talk vampires. Can you define Can you define what a vampire is? What is a vampire?
Well, basically, it's a cursed soul, someone who is immortal that has unlimited knowledge on a lot of things that have been restricted to us as mortals. Very strong, have very different abilities depending on their age, I guess is the best way to put it. There's some blogs on my site which define the age of a vampire and what abilities they should have by a certain age. But what best defines a vampire is, I guess, more or less where the vampire legend is. And, you know, there are a ton of origination theories. The one that I lean closest towards, and let me stop here, people ask me all the time, are vampires real?
Lynn, that was my next question. Are vampires real? No, that's good. Do vampires exist? Are they real?
Not in the sense that we understand them now in society. Were they real? They were very real at one point. And let me explain to you why I believe that. In the King James Version of the Bible, you will see the word Lilith one time. However, you have to keep in mind that King James had that Bible edited before he allowed it to go back out into the public as his version. So there are several other ancient texts out there, such as the Book of Jubilees, several books that were removed from the Bible. One of my favorite is the Book of Enoch. That's a very interesting read. Who Lilith was actually the first wife to Adam. It says in the Book of Jubilees and in Enoch that Lilith was created along with Adam from the dust of the earth, and she saw herself as an equal to Adam. Adam didn't see things that way. And after a while, Lilith became, she was very unhappy because she was forced to be subservient to Adam 24/7, and she had enough, put her foot down and left. And long story short, Adam found himself without a mate, cried to God. God took a rib from him and created Eve of him, which was subservient. But Lilith went to live by the Red Sea. And from what Enoch says, as well as what the Bible says, there were 199 angels that were cast down from heaven because they lusted for the flesh of the mortal women. And God had forbid them from ever having contact with them. Well, they decided they were going to do what they wanted to do. And as a result of these, what I refer to as the fallen angels, the fallen, mating with mortal females, the Nephilim was born. Now, the Nephilim were known to be giants. However, there are several references in different ancient texts that describe how this mating process took place. Because obviously a 30-foot man is not going to mate with a typical 5-foot female. It's not going to happen. It just can't.
Right.
It was done under some sense of possession, like a demonic possession. Angels can do the same thing. You hear people say all the time, I was filled with the Holy Spirit. Bluntly, that's a form of possession. It's a good thing, but we view possession just like we view that word psychic. We connect it with something evil, and that's not always the case. Well, the offspring of the Nephilim and the humans were different. They were stronger. They had knowledge that had only been given to those that dwelt in the heavens, and they had abilities that regular mortals didn't have. And they taught and virtually corrupted the human race, which is why God flooded the earth at the time of Noah, because the DNA of the Nephilim had been spread throughout mankind, and it was corrupted. So that was his way of removing them and removing that corrupted DNA from the planet. So that is my belief on where vampires originated from. However, you have other theories that also happened in the era of the Bible. One of them is the Cain theory. There were said to be different tribes of vampires that had evolved or had been created by Cain. And the one mark that was specific with him was Cain had red hair, and that was very unusual at the time. So all of the Canaanites were said to have had red hair and were all of the vampire influence, I guess the word would say, because they fed on blood. They were nocturnal. They were different. They had more abilities. They were bigger. They were stronger. They were smarter. So they had that gene within them. Another very popular theory, also from Bible times, is the Judas theory, which is where the fear of silver and the fear of sun, and there was one other thing. Oh, the cross, the actual crucifix, because it was a reminder of his curse, because God cursed him to walk the earth forever until the end of time, when he would then take him and all of his offspring from the planet after Judgment Day. He was going to be the last person that God removed from the planet. So Judas is a very strong vampire theory. And, of course, there's many others. These are the ones that are known domestically, I guess, best to us, but in different cultures there are very similar stories, just different characters. So it all depends on where you're at when you ask the question about a vampire and his characteristics.
So in essence, vampires, in a way, do exist. They have existed since ancient times.
I think so, yes.
Well, I mean, going back, of course, to other countries, in India, Kali was a four-armed individual that had fangs and supposedly drank blood. And in Malaysia, Langswir was described as a long-haired woman who had fangs as well. And so in other cultures, this seemed to have developed as well.
That's right. And Egypt, very strong in Egyptian times. King Menes, I assume is how you pronounce that, and Sekhmet, same characteristics. They were known as gods and warriors. And they all had those same traits.
Now, as this developed, of course, in Romania and Hungary, where some of the main vampire stuff comes from, the Countess Bathory. Are you familiar?
Uh-huh, right.
Yeah.
And Vlad the Impaler.
And with Countess Bathory, you know, she killed like 650 people to bathe in their blood because she thought it made her more youthful.
Right, right. And that is actually one of the well-known stories that I have not delved a little bit deeper into, simply because of the way she did things. She had some vampiric traits, however, not quite full-blown, so I never really dug into her any deeper. Vlad Tepes is a lot more interesting to me, and there's a history beyond his mortal death as well. You can visit there today, and they say that you can still see him. He does still make appearances, so he actually haunts the grounds there around his old castle.
Lynn, is that where the wooden stake thing came from? Although, you know, he impaled people and put them upright. Is that kind of where the wooden stake through the heart thing came from with vampires?
I don't have an exact answer for that, but I'd be willing to bet it does have something to do with it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, there are some clinical conditions that also would give someone vampire-like behavior. There's clinical vampirism, anemia, which is, of course, a iron deficiency, and porphyria. Porphyria is a lack of heme or hemoglobin in the body. And hemoglobin, of course, is responsible for binding oxygen to the red blood cells being carried throughout the body. And of course, when one doesn't have oxygen going throughout the body, they become lethargic. They become weak, as a vampire would if they were lacking energy. And in some of the old textbooks, the old medical textbooks, the cure for that was to drink someone else's blood.
That's right, bloodletting. That's exactly right. And that happened kind of during the Middle Ages when the revenant type of vampire was running rampant, I guess is the best way to describe it. And, you know, those were people like you, I, our family members, our neighbors that would pass away from the plague or what have you, but rise again from the grave. So it was a little bit different than being cursed or being bitten by someone that's cursed or whatever the case may be. The revenants were mortal and came back from the grave. So there were all kind of techniques that were used to keep that from happening as well, depending on which region you were in.
Now, Lynn, you're the vampire expert, so I have to ask you this question because I came across in some of the research that I was doing a little bit conflicting things here. Is it that the vampire drinks the victim's blood and then the victim becomes a vampire, or is it that the victim drinks the vampire's blood and becomes a vampire?
Okay, that's a good question. a vampire can feed from someone without infecting them up until the point of death. At the point of death, when the body is completely drained of blood, then the vampire feeds the victim the blood. Therefore, the genes are now, or the DNA is now in the victim, and they become as their maker.
I see. So then I'm still a little bit unclear. Who drinks whose blood?
The victim. The victim must ingest the vampire or the infected one's blood in order to be infected themselves.
And how does the vampire do that? There's something known as the vampire's stare. A vampire has a certain stare or something?
Right. They have the ability to not possess, but to hypnotize and have a human fall in love with them if they want to, or direct them to doing whatever their will is at that point in time. If they just need a servant to watch over them during the day, then they can hypnotize that human, and that becomes their life's purpose. That's what they want to do.
Lynn, do vampires have a connection with animals?
Yes. I'm not real sure how that comes about, but an animal, and even with any different paranormal events, animals are very sensitive to the presence of something that you or I might not see. They see it, and I guess we would have to be able to know what an animal is thinking in order to completely understand that. But yes, they do sense something different, and if it doesn't fall into the norm, it of course will upset the animal, and the animal is going to let the owner know something's not quite right here.
And do vampires take on the characteristic of animals, of the animals that they favor?
There are some legends in different regions that do state that a vampire can shift into the form of a wolf or a bat, or, you know, whatever they choose. You see that rarely, mostly in the Romanian legends, like we were talking about earlier. That's kind of where that's more typical than any of the other legends in other areas.
And there's something that I read about vampires liking to lurk in the shadows. How true is that?
Saying that they like to lurk in the shadows?
Yes, yeah, according to the research that I did. But again, you're the expert, and that's why we're asking you, because you're going to set us straight one way or the other.
Well, I just didn't quite hear you. I wanted to make sure I heard the question correctly. Because people are fascinated with them. They've been around for centuries. They're well aware that folks are fascinated with them. And there's a piece of poetry that I wrote that kind of explains that. They like to sit back and observe without being the main focus of everyone that's around them. They've been out of the life of the living for so long. They like to sit back and observe life, regular, everyday, mortal life that we think is humdrum, is something that is outside of their grasp. But in this poem, there's a vampire that's actually sitting back in the shadows, and he's watching this young lady that goes to the side of the river, and he's kind of mesmerized by her, but he feels a sadness within her that he hasn't felt in a long time. And then it dawns on him that she's fixing to take her own life. So he claimed her as his princess and brought her into the dark world, but where she would be loved and cared for, where she wasn't, in normal life, in her mortal life.
We're talking vampires tonight on Nightcast. Lynn, we have to have you hold there. We're going to step aside for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Lynn about the Adrian Trilogy, to be his soulmate, Adrian's Fury, and Adrian's Legacy. I'm Ian Morris, and we'll be back.
Be sure to visit the website at radiob88.com. This is Nightcast.
We're back from break. Welcome back to Nightcast. If you'd like to become a guest on Nightcast, you can email us at nightcast@radiob88.com or go to our website at radiob88.com and go to the Be a Guest page. You can also email us with comments and questions. Our guest this evening is a vampire expert, historian, novelist, author of the Adrian Trilogy. Lynn Gibson from Louisiana joins us this evening. Lynn, let's talk about your books. Let's talk about the Adrian Trilogy. The first book that you wrote was To Be His Soulmate. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, I'll do that. It's written in modern times. It's focused around a young businesswoman that is actually in the real estate industry. And it gives a little bit of background on her. And she's actually a sensitive. She dreams and has visions, but she's put those on the back burner because she's involved in her career. But there's one particular dream that she's had for as long as she can remember, and it's of a man and a woman, but they have no face. But she knows they're happy together, and then she knows that something terrible happens, and that's all she knows. And it just so comes to pass that she runs into this man. And at that point, she didn't know. She knew who he was. She knew his relevance to her, but she didn't know that he was a vampire. And she also didn't know that she was fixing to be his lunch or dinner at this point in time. And the Christian, which is the male character in the book who she encounters, actually has a very long history, and he's got a very long, violent history. He was cursed by the gods and because he became vengeful, over the death or the murder of his true love, and had been searching for centuries for her to come back for him. So that's kind of the basis of the first book. It talks about growing pains of a mortal/immortal union. There are clans that are not approving of her presence with them, and there are different clan clashes. So it actually, there's a romantic base for the book, but it's very violent. Lots of blood, lots of biting and fighting.
Lynn, does it take place in Louisiana or in the region where you are?
Most of the book does, yes.
That would be fascinating. That would be very fascinating. What a great backdrop.
Right, and the locals here actually love it because they can read about landmarks and places that are really here and are being described and named in the book, as well as people that are all over the world that are reading it, because they're getting a little taste of Louisiana with the legend and lore mixed in with it. So, there's a little something in it for everyone. It's intriguing for all readers, not just females, males, and anyone over 18.
Right, and it's a great, as I said, it's a great place for that. Did you take some of the folklore from the area and inject it into this book?
I took the basis of the folklore and kind of wove it into Christian and Adrian's story, yes. So someone who's familiar with local legend and lore, they can read it and go, I know where that came from, you know?
Okay, so you decided to write your first book. And again, you like all things paranormal. Why did you choose the vampire theme?
Well, like we were talking about earlier, I've always been a horror fan. And, you know, the Friday the 13th, the Amityville Horror, the Exorcist, all of those hardcore horror flicks that just now the horror flicks that are coming out pale in comparison. And my motivating factor was the last Twilight movie that came out. I'm like, okay, you know, enough is enough. So we're going to set it straight. This is what vampires are about. And when I got started with it, I myself got so involved in the story that I wanted to see it move forward, and that's what I did with coming out with the second and third parts of the trilogy.
Now, Lynn, it seems like, you know, like the books or really more so in cinema, the movies that come out, they're all action and no substance. And I've noticed that in your books, there's story. There's story.
There are actually several different storylines that are going on at the same time. And the series is in script writing right now, so hopefully at some point we may be seeing it on Showtime or HBO. Anything's possible.
Now let's talk about, now you went on with the series. You went on to Adrian's Fury. Tell us about that book.
Where the first book was more in lines of giving the backstory of the main characters in the first book, Adrian the second book is basically focused on her. There is a little bit of Christian in there, but it gives the viewpoint of a mortal who has now been taken over by this DNA that we've been talking about, the changes that she's going through emotionally, physically, and it may, she's having a struggle inside with the immortal part of her who is trying to take over the mortal part. So it gives the reader a very good sense of how it would actually feel to be turned. And you know, what are the things that I would have as a mortal would have to do to be able to function as an immortal.
So it's more about the transition, her transition?
The undertone is, yes. But the story does progress. There are still clan battles. It's very, very hectic and very violent times. And there's a war going on, and I guess is the basis of the second book. And it's kind of a go-between the third one, Adrian's Legacy, which is, you know, it's kind of like the grand finale. It's a little bit over 600 pages, and it takes us from Adrian as a mortal or to Adrian as an immortal and the fall of the other clans and, you know, the progression of the planet, the progression of the country. It gets a little bit political. There's a little taste of everything in there, and it even actually goes way into the future and gives you a glimpse of what things may be like 40 or 50 years from now.
Now, going back to Adrian's fury, why did you use the term fury?
Because she is pissed.
that's what I was getting at. And that's probably not a good thing for a vampire to be like that.
That's exactly right. There had been a lot of loss of life around her because of these clan attacks. Because she was a mortal that was now the mate of an immortal, they wanted to kill both of them, all of the clans. So she lost a lot of friends and family, and I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail, but when she came back, she got justice for those that perished because of it.
Lynn, how much of the vampire traits do you bring into it? Because you've done the research, I'm sure you know what's real and what's just made up. How much of the vampire traits did you inject into the character of Adrian? Did you inject only the real stuff, or did you kind of use a little leeway?
No, I try to stick with the true legends and the true lore. Of course, they cannot tolerate sunlight. There is the thirst for blood, and there's really some great descriptions in there of how she felt when she was surrendering to that thirst and that hunger. And once again, that battle within, it was terrible for her. But she did overcome, and she became something else. And the thing that's a little bit different about her than maybe a typical vampire is she was gifted going into this. So she was a little bit different of a breed than what was already out there. And for her to be something that's low, a mortal that was turned, all of these elders are looking at her, and she has abilities that are just about equal to them, and that doesn't sit very well with them because she could read their minds. She knew what they were thinking. She knew what was going to happen, and that was not a good position for her to be in as a newly turned vampire because she was still susceptible to them. But she caught on real quick.
Lynn, I have a question about that, and you brought up something that again, there was a conflict in as far as vampires and daylight. In Bram Stoker's Dracula, he was able to walk out in the daylight. But there was a movie that came out which actually stole the entire story of Dracula, Nosferatu. And it was an old cinema where the writer changed the ending just so he wouldn't get sued, where he made the vampire walk past a window and kind of disintegrate. And there's some controversy about that's where the light thing came in. I would trust your opinion. What do you think?
I have found no research on any continent in any era that ever says that the vampire can exist and function in daylight. The ultimate curse is from God the Father, because God is, God was, and God is going to be. And when he cursed Judas and or Cain or, you know, whoever the case may be that was the first actual vampire, that was part of the curse that they would walk in darkness. No one can undo that. no one. So I give little credit to any vampire that you see in the daylight, period.
Okay, so that answers that question. So Adrian, does she know what's happening to her? I mean, obviously she does, because she's getting very, as you put it, she's getting very pissed. So,
right.
Does she know what's happening to her? And in her legacy, why the legacy? Does she leave behind? I mean, I don't want you to give away the entire book, but tell us about a little bit about the legacy that's left behind.
I'm trying to think how I could word this without giving a whole lot away.
And if not, we understand.
Oh, no, that's fine. You know, all things evolve. Even humans evolve. Animals evolve. And in this case, so do vampires. And the old ways don't work anymore, because the world is not the place that it was when Adrian was immortal. So things have to be acclimated. And all of the elders with the old way of thinking, they're gone. And all that are left are a few vagrants that have the vampire gene, and they don't really realize what they are. I will go into this, that the government has maybe imprisoned, would be a good word. They've taken all of the vampires, shoved them into dark places, and they feed them occasionally just to keep them alive. But they're not allowed to go out. They're not allowed to breed. They're, you know, not allowed to multiply, whatever the case may be. So they really have no knowledge of what it means to be a vampire. Adrian comes back and teaches them this, but she's still got just a tad bit of the mortal senses left in her, I guess. Compassion maybe is the word. So she has taught the remaining humans and the remaining vampires how to live in unison. And it takes a little bit of adjusting on both sides, and some of it's a little bit violent. And then the government, as always, is against them. So quite a battle ensues, but there is quite a legacy that is left in her name.
The Adrian Trilogy. We're going to pause for a break. When we come back, we're going to ask Lynn some questions that our listeners have sent to us to ask the expert. Lynn Gibson joins us this evening on Nightcast from Louisiana. I'm Ian Morris, and we'll be right back.
This is Nightcast.
We're back from break. Never miss another show. Become a Nightcaster by going to the Nightcast page at RadioB88.com. And as a special Nightcaster, you will always be notified of new and upcoming Nightcast shows. I'm Ian Morris. Our guest tonight, a vampire expert, historian, novelist, author of the Adrian Trilogy. Lynn Gibson from Louisiana joins us this evening. Lynn, we had our listeners send in questions all week long in anticipation of your show, and we'd like to ask you some of those questions. The first question, how do you recognize a vampire?
I guess that depends on if the vampire wants you to recognize it or not. If it is open to being seen, the first thing that you will notice if you are in tune to yourself at all is that they will likely get into your mind before anything else. You will feel them pondering around in your mind, trying to figure things out about you before you see the fierceness in their eyes, before you notice the tips of their fangs that may be hidden just beneath their lips, before you notice that they may be a little bit more in tune to things that are going on around you that other people don't see. So bottom line is that vampire has to be open to letting you know that he's there.
Okay, and the second...
And he may not even let you remember that. There's a possibility that he may come out to you, tell you the things that you want to know, and then hypnotize you and disappear, and it's gone. So it really depends on the vampire.
Right. Our second question, do vampires all have fangs?
As far as my research goes, yes, they all have fangs. Some have some different things. Some have a tongue that is kind of cylindrical to suck with and may or may not use their fangs. Most of them also have claws of some kind. Even the humanoid type of vampires, they still have a longer and thicker and more pointy fingernail than a human would.
Next question that our listeners sent in. Is it true that vampires don't need sleep?
They don't need it the way that a human does. We need sleep for our body to heal and to recharge. They're not driven that way. They sleep during the day simply because there's nothing else to do unless they're in a situation where they're free to roam about during the day. For example, some of the properties that are in the Adrian trilogy have steel shutters on all of the windows, so light doesn't penetrate their homes. They're up all day. It's not a requirement. A vampire is known to hibernate. Even though most of their mortal characteristics do fade away with time, there are two very strong mortal sensations that never go all the way away. One is love, one is hate. So let's say that a vampire has lost his mate and he's heartbroken. It's very possible that that vampire may hibernate for days, weeks, years, centuries in order to be able to function again in society in some way.
Lynn, the next question is, are vampires the undead?
Yes. Yes, there are no vampires with a pulse and a heartbeat in any legend on any region in any era that I have run across.
Our next question, do vampires sleep in coffins or caskets?
No, not anymore. There were a lack of options maybe in the earlier centuries, to where that was the only place that they could find darkness, or maybe a dungeon of a castle or a cave that was deep underground. It's not a requirement that they sleep in a coffin or a casket. It could be the trunk of a car, just anywhere where sun doesn't leach in and you know, have the possibility of burning them.
Can vampires fly?
A newborn vampire cannot. A newborn does not automatically assume the same traits as his maker. But as time progresses, so do their skills. As an infant begins with pushing itself up, then eventually crawling, then walking, same thing with a vampire. Their abilities build after time. A mortal ages and, I guess, has a better grip on their abilities a lot faster than a vampire. Where a mortal child will crawl to walk within a matter of months, it may take a vampire a matter of centuries to gain the ability to be able to fly. But yes, they do.
I see. Do vampires only eat or drink blood, and they can't eat normal food?
They can, but they have no taste for it. There's no desire for it. One dish that you may not like, squash. You know, if you've got a table full of food and someone puts a plate of squash in front of you, you're likely not going to eat it. Why? Because you don't want it. You have no desire for it. So, yes, they could sit and entertain and actually eat the same thing a mortal does. But, you know, if you've been around for 1,000 years, you're kind of in tune to not doing what you don't want to do.
Okay. And another question, do vampires kill people for food or for blood? Do they kill people?
No. If just to feed, No. Like I said, those two emotions that kind of stick with you, love and hate, would they kill? Oh, yeah. But there has to be a reason for it, and sustenance is not enough of a reason to evoke a vampire to kill.
Only two more questions, Lynn. Does sunlight kill vampires?
If exposed long enough, yes, because as we were speaking about earlier, that's the ultimate curse, and that's they were told they will never walk in the sunlight, so it is meant to destroy a vampire.
Okay. Lynn, the last question. Are vampires immortal?
Yes. Until, like we were talking about the Judas theory, Judas was cursed to walk the earth until the end of days when God himself said he would remove him last from the planet. So in order to do that, you must be immortal.
Well, Lynn Gibson is our guest. She is a vampire expert, historian, and novelist. She is the author of the Adrian Trilogy. Lynn, what else are you working on? What new projects do you have coming up?
Well, actually, I do have something that's in the copyright process. I do a lot of horror cons and different events to where families are present. And, of course, the teenagers are driven to my books because, you know, everybody's into the vampire thing. It's kind of like being in the 90s again when Anne Rice was just coming out with Interview with a Vampire. It's just a new wave of it. But I do not sell my books to anyone under 18, so therefore there was a problem. In answer to that problem, I created something called Short and Gory, and it's kind of like the old creep shows in the 80s. Remember the shows where there were three or four different creepy
stories? Oh, yes, I do, yes.
Okay. Well, this is a compilation of five different short stories that are they're all horror and all gore. So if somebody is not into maybe the paranormal gore, horror, violence, stuff like that, they're not going to like the books. But it's a good read for someone 13 and over. There is violence, but the language is cleaned up. There's no sexual content. So it's, you know, it's a good little read. And I've had it pre-screened by several adults, and they found the stories very intriguing and were able to read right through them without putting the book down. So that's a good sign that it's going to be an attention getter.
Lynn, how soon will that be coming out?
That should be out sometime within the next 2 months, pending printing and the copyright process, which should be just about finished by now, I would say. Hopefully we'll get that out here right at the end of spring, early summer. And I'm currently writing on my fifth novel. I'm about 300 pages into it and real close to finishing it, which it might come out at the end of this year. And that is it's a truth based on fiction. And it does have vampire air to it. It's something that's come near and dear to me that has really tweaked my curiosity is the Nephilim theory and all of the evidence that's being excavated and all of the writings and ancient texts. So I've done a lot of research on that, and that's kind of the gist of the book. And it's going to be an eye-opener because of the facts that are in it. There are going to be some religious people that are not real happy with it, but if they're facts. You know,
right,
facts.
Right. We did forget to ask you one last question. And it's kind of appropriate that we're coming up on the end here. How does one defend oneself against a vampire, be it a regular vampire or a, quote, psychic or energy vampire? How does one defend oneself?
There are a whole bunch of different ways that are said. UV lights is one of them. Garlic is one of them. And I think that came from Indian legend. Silver, they don't like. That's the werewolves as well. They don't like silver, but for a different reason. And, of course, the crucifix, which I would probably use myself if I were ever in that situation because of the strength and the power that's affiliated with the sign of the cross.
Lynn, do you have a website?
I actually have several. You can find me on authorlynngibson.com. I have two separate blogs. One is connected to that site. The second one is author Lynn Gibson at WordPress. I'm on Facebook. You can find me there under author Lynn Gibson or under Southern Horror Queen. So pretty easy to find me. If all else fails, you can just type author Lynn Gibson into the Google search bar and you'll find me.
As well, if you can't remember for some reason, you can always go to the radiob88.com website. Go to the Nightcast page. At the bottom, you'll see Nightcast shows. Click on that And you'll see Lynn Gibson's show listed for tonight as well. There'll be links to her website and to her Facebook page. Lynn, where can our listeners find your books?
Right now, I am online on the Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Books A Million websites. You can also pick up the Adrian Trilogy on my publisher's page at Donna Inc. Publications. And if you want autograph copies, you can inbox me on Facebook, and we can take care of that.
Lynn, we'd like to thank you for being our guest tonight on Nightcast, and we'd like to thank you, our listeners, for joining us. Till next time, I'm Ian Morris. Have a good night, everyone.
This has been Nightcast. Be sure to visit the website at radiob88.com.